Accession number 18475, Reel 5.
Arnold Baldwin, Reel 1. Reel 5, sorry. I think there's something you wanted to say about the relationship between RAF and the glider pilot regiment in the early days of the war.
Yes. To start with, the air crews that were employed as on tugging had all obviously trained to become bomber crews. And I think they felt that it was a bit of a come down to be simply stooging around the English countryside, tugging gliders around instead of being on the way to bomb Berlin or whatever. And it was a little bit cool, I think, at first. But we were fortunate in a sense that we were able to establish friendly relations between the RAF crews and our own Japs, and it was done slowly, but it became quite a firm relationship in the end. Many of us were able to form an alliance, if you like, with one particular tug crew, and we would always go up with them. At first, it was all higgledy-piggledy and anybody took anybody else up, as it were. But we did establish fairly early in 1943 this friendliness between crews, RAF crews and glider pilots, so that we appealed to the CO that we would like to go with this chap every time, as it were. And so in the end, we did become crewed together, so that glider pilots always had the same tug pilots. And it, of course, this was very useful when it came to operations as well, because a feeling of confidence, mutual confidence, was there. For instance, I had the same tug crew for D-Day and then for Arnhem, but unfortunately, they were posted off on a course before the Rhine crossing, so I had somebody on, a tug man on the Rhine crossing whom I'd never met and didn't know at all. Didn't really make any difference, but the feeling was that we'd achieved between the... I mean, we would go out drinking together, we partied together. We had a jolly good relationship with them. That made a big difference, I think. One of the reasons why eventually they became quite proud of the fact, they felt that they were missing out on the war in a sense, where others of their comrades were going over and risking their lives, not merely risking them, but losing them in a lot of cases, because they had very heavy losses, as you must know, the Bomber Command. Instead of that, they were just simply stooging around England, and they felt that they weren't really being properly used, I suppose. But towards the end of the war, and after we'd had one or two operations in which they realised that it was tugging gliders to a certain rendezvous was... an even more skilled job, in a sense, than a night bombing raid, because the accuracy that was called for was not merely to release a glider or let a glider release itself in a position where it could get into a certain field or area, but also a certain corner of that field, as it were, so that the navigation that was called for, they felt, was a bit above the normal, and this gave them a bit of a boost. They felt that they were doing something very worthwhile, whereas in the early days it seemed a bit of a drag, I think. Anyway, we did have this very good relationship with them, and I was very sorry to lose my tug crew just before the Rhine crossing when they went off on a course.
Now, I think the second big operation you did was Arnhem. Can you take me through that step by step as it affected you in detail, please?
Yes, I will try to recall most of the salient features. B Squadron, of which I was a member, had been regularly stationed at Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire, and it was from Bryce Norton that we did the D-Day operation. But for Arnhem, the tugs that we had, the Albemarle, did not have the range to make it to Holland from Bryce, so that the whole unit was transferred to on the Kent coast.
Manston?
Manston, sorry. You'll have to forgive me, but this happens all the time. Yes, we went to Manston, and we were there for a whole week before we actually took off for the operation. A lot of people think that this is where leaks may have occurred in security, and that the final disaster of Arnhem, because you could only describe it as a disaster, the first seeds of that disaster may have been sown from careless talk at Manston. I personally don't think that's the case, but it was a theory that was fairly commonplace at the time. Can you stop it just a second? I had the same tug crew, Dennis Richards and his crew, for the Arnhem op from Manston. They were, of course, flying Albemarles. We had quite a steady crossing, but before that, I must say that two things. One, Major Toler, who was the CO of B Squadron, had told me, who took off second behind him, to formate quite closely. Well, this rather amused me, because a glider can't formate on its own. It goes where the tug goes. And so I'd said to my tug pilot, Dennis Richards, that the CO would like a pretty tight formation. Well, nothing would have pleased Dennis more than this. He was a bit of a mad character as a pilot anyway. He should have been, I think, a fighter pilot. I think he was wrongly placed. And of course, he practically sat in the Major's tug's pocket, as it were. And Major Taylor remarked to me afterwards, he said, I asked you to fly pretty close, he said, but I didn't expect you were going to try and come in the cockpit with me. I said, I couldn't help it. I said, it was Dennis, of course. Well, we had an easy flight. It was fascinating to be in a stream like that, heading for Holland. For me, I was very gung-ho about going to. I suppose it was because I'd had an absolute failure on D-Day. And I felt that this was a chance to really get to grips with it. Just before we did take off, one of my colleagues, who was not going on the first lift, there were three lifts all told for Arnhem, he was going on either the second or the third. He stood at the side of the runway as we were hitching up, and he looked very concerned. He was opposite my cockpit, down on the side of the runway, and he suddenly said to me, "For Christ's sake, be careful, Arnold." Well, this rather startled me, because I had no feelings of apprehension or anything before going on this. I thought it was just, you know, we were going to give them a good belting, and that was it. So I said, "Oh, there's nothing to worry about." And his name was Bob Harris, and he said, I'm worried, Arnold. He said, I don't like it. He said, I don't like it at all. Well, whether he had any premonition about it or not, I don't know, but I subsequently learned that he'd been killed at Arnhem, which saddened me. The journey over there, as I was saying, was fascinating because we'd never flown in such large formations. And there were two streams crossing the North Sea, and it seemed almost as far as the eye could see, there were a combination of tugs and gliders and also Dakotas with the paraboys on them and so on. And no matter how far you craned and looked each way, this seemed to go on forever. Okay. There was little in the way of action of any sort in the crossing. We were escorted by our fighter planes all the way across. They were darting and chasing around us all the time. We had nothing to fear in that respect. And there was little anti-aircraft fire as we approached the landing zones. And in fact, we made a landing so easy that it could have been on an exercise. Major Tola, as I said, was the first one off from us, and I was next behind him, and we landed on our LZ in a perfect position, quite close up, tight to each other. As we ran down to a stop on the ground, there was some small arms fire a little way off. I never did locate exactly where it was. Well, we unloaded and sat in this field. We were near to a slight hollow in the ground, and my co-pilot, Joe Michie, remarked to me that it was just like another exercise. He said it's hard to believe that actually we are supposed to be in action. Nothing's happening at all. And in fact, and this is where I think, although many, many books have been written about Arnhem and what went wrong and why it went wrong and so on, I think it went wrong from the very beginning. Because there was no sense of urgency. We must have landed there roughly about midday or early afternoon. And there we sat in this hollow. Eventually, I think our loads, and we were carrying men from the 2nd Battalion of the South Staffs, they did move off, but all the glider pilots remained on the LZ. And in fact, we spent the night sleeping in this hollow, Joe and I, a couple of others, but the whole squadron and others, presumably, from other squadrons, just didn't move up. Eventually, during the next day, we started marching down the road towards Arnhem. And it was quite an astonishing experience, really, because we were marching more or less in single file, through the outskirts, the suburbs of Arnhem, quite well-to-do, large gardens and beautiful houses and so on, and the people were coming to their front gates and handing us fruit and everything. It was hard to believe that we were supposed to be at war at all, at that part of the approach to it. And we marched for some miles, and we went finally through the Oosterbeek suburb, and it was then, by then, we'd, with frequent halts and waits and so on, it became quite dark eventually, and we were on what I would call the middle road into Arnhem from Oosterbeek. There was one road that ran along the banks of the Rhine almost, one on higher ground, that we were on, and one still higher, so that three roads were converging into Arnhem, and we were in the middle one. And night fell, and we were stopped, and we just crouched down beside a garden wall, and a lot of firing was going on, both from the bridge and towards the bridge, and it was none of it was really close to us, close enough to worry us, but there was a pretty fierce fight going on, that was obvious, and we were just sat there as spectators of it, still some miles from the bridge, I might say. Well, we spent the night really crouched beside this wall, and the next morning the order came to the glider pilots to retrace their steps and go back to Oosterbeek. Well, we came to the church, the small church near the Rhine, and I recall we spent a night in the garden there with one of our guns just behind us, which occasionally fired. I'm not sure what they could be firing at, but nothing much happened, except it was a miserable night. We found the Germans had had their form of trench there, not slit trenches as we dug, but they did one-man ones. They were rather circular sort of holes, which they would drop into and simply crouch down as low as they could in these holes. They didn't have a trench in the normal sense of the word. So we spent a night like that. And the following morning, we were moved back into the grounds of the Hartenstein Hotel, which was to become the headquarters of the division. We were at the back of the Hartenstein Hotel, at the rear, where there was a tennis court with very high wire fencing around it, which became a prisoner compound. As the odd Germans were collected as prisoners, they were marched into this tennis court and shoved in there. We dug ourselves slit trenches between a row of poplar trees, which were, I would say, about 12 feet apart, something like that. And we'd dug slit trenches in between, and two or three of us would man each of these slit trenches in turn. We were then facing away from the Hartenstein towards Oosterbeek itself, and in between us and the first street that ran down from the what was called the MDS crossroad down to the church near the river on the lower road, this road that ran from one to the other, we thought was occupied, but we couldn't tell who it was occupied. But in between us and that road was a large allotment, many allotments, I think, rather like we have in England, where you have a big area of allotments and various people have their own patch, as it were. And it was rather similar there. Largely at that time of the year, there were bean poles galore everywhere, so it was a bit difficult to see right the way through properly. But it seemed to us that houses were occupied in the first road on the far side of the allotments. We weren't sure who was in them, whether it was Germans or whether it was some of our boys. In the end, we discovered a few days later that it was our chaps there. Anyway, one of the amusing things that happened then was just by this tennis court, there was a small hut where the Dutch people had had an electric stove and where they could warm food or make tea or whatever while they were having an afternoon in the tennis court. And for some reason, the Germans had neglected to cut off the electricity supply and they'd neglected to cut off the water. So we were getting a early mortaring then, not much of it, but they were firing mortars at us from somewhere. And in between this, we would dash across to this little hut, fill a Dixie with water, put it on the electric stove and brew up. And it seemed ridiculous, really, that such a silly thing was going on. But eventually, of course, the Germans cottoned on to what was happening and they cut both water and electricity off. The mortaring wasn't at that stage too severe, but I think on about the third day, we spent a couple of nights, I think. No, wait a minute. It would have been about the third day, but only one night spent in these trenches because we'd spent two nights already. So on the third, or would it be the fourth day? I'm not positive about that. The mortaring became a bit heavier and more accurate. And as I said, we were dug in between a long line of poplar trees, quite tall, very tall trees. And on one occasion, I really thought the end had come for us because one of these mortar bombs must have hit high up in this tree. I've never known such an explosion. And although we were crouching down in the slit trenches, I felt as if somebody had hit me on top of the helmet with a 14-pound hammer. It almost drove my head down flush with my shoulders. The concussion from the explosion. Fragments of the mortar bomb were scattered around, but one peculiar thing, my co-pilot Joe Michie had somewhere picked up a Sten gun. I don't think he'd been issued with it. How he got it, I'm not sure. All I'd got was a rifle. And I lent this thing against the trunk of the tree at the end of the slit trench. And of course, the magazine was in it, right? And they fitted in, as you probably know, in a Sten. They're at right angles to the gun itself. And after this massive explosion, I looked up when I felt safe enough to do so, and the gun was still lodging against the tree, but a piece of the shrapnel from the shell had gone clean through the magazine, but without even knocking the gun down. It struck me as rather odd that. I then drew Mitch's attention to it, and I went to draw the attention of the blokes in the slit trench on the other side of the tree. And I called out to them, and I got no response. And I thought, what the devil's the matter with them? So I looked around the tree, and, well, there's some confusion here. I thought there were three men in that trench, and all three were dead. I was subsequently told there was only one man in it, and he was dead. Certainly there was at least one dead man in the trench. I thought there were more. So I realised then what a narrow escape we'd had. Well, after that, the Sergeant Major came round. Sergeant Major what? a big jock from the Cameronians and a smashing man. I think we were all very, very fond of Bill. And he came round and he said to me, he always called me Baldy. And he said, Baldy, I want you and Joe. And then he selected about six of us, roughly. I want you to come with me. You're being seconded to the parachute regiment, he said. They're getting a bit short of blokes. So, myself, Joe Mitchie, two other staff sergeants. One was Bert Stroud. Bert was quite an elderly man. He had the appearance of being a very elderly man. I was one of the older ones in the regiment, but Bert, I think, could give me a few years. He was one of them. Another one was another jock, Thompson, Bill Thompson. Another one, Ginger Eardley. And I believe a fellow named Clifty Rungery was one of the second pilots who came along with us. Anyway, there were about six. And Bill took us up to the end of the allotment area, along the top of the allotment area, into this road that ran parallel to where we were in the trenches. We walked down this road for some little way, and then Bill turned into an alleyway between two houses, or between a boundary wall and a house. It was a very narrow passageway, and he was taking us round to the back door when we came under fire. How Bill was missed and how I was missed, I'm not sure, but Bill Thompson, who was immediately behind me, I heard him cry out. We were then, when the firing started, we were dashing for the back door to get shelter, and we heard Bill cry out, and I turned, and he was down on the ground. He had his leg rather badly smashed, and Bill and I managed to drag him into the house behind us, into the back door. Inside, Bill wrenched a door off its hinges, and we used that as a stretcher to put Bill on. We took him out towards the front door, the street door, and our chaps were going about with motorbikes and sidecars with stretchers, and it transpired in the end that there were they weren't equipped as hospitals, but two hotels, one at each end of this stretch of road, had been taken over as field dressing stations. And we got Bill onto a motorcycle unit, and he was taken off to hospital. Subsequently, we found he was, of course, taken prisoner. And I didn't see him again until after the war. And when I did meet him, he was limping quite badly. But he was full of praise for the German surgeon, who he was quite certain had saved his leg for him. Although he walked with a limp, he'd got his leg. Well, he felt that but for the skill of that surgeon, he would have...